Sports Ethos New York Knicks podcast, Andre Gallagher. Game one in the books. In the books, you take it and run. No worries. No judging victories. You take it and run. Too many of y'all are out here trying to judge victories. You're not judging victories anymore. It's just like I told you midway through the season. There were no more test games. It's just wins and losses. That's it. That's all that matters in the playoffs. Wins and losses. The only reason why you're judging the victory is because you think the Knicks are a dominant team over the Pacers. That's a mistake. That's a mistake. And I didn't get a chance to go into it before the series, but this Pacers team is more than capable of beating this Knicks team. More than capable. They're a deeper team. They score a ton of points, and they run up and down the court. The Knicks are playing with a skeleton crew and like to slow the game down. It's a clash in styles. And at any given point, and they have a shooting center, at any given point, they can put up 140 points in a game. And the Knicks are heavily dependent on one guy night in, night out. You're telling me the Pacers aren't capable of winning games? It's ridiculous. Of course they are. And if you came into this series thinking, oh, okay, the Knicks are a much better team. Look how they played against the Sixers. We don't believe in the Pacers. So the Knicks should win every game by 15, 20 points. I don't know if you've ever watched the NBA before. That's not how any of this is going to work. I don't care if the Knicks win every game by 1 point. All that matters is they win. That's it. Okay? Now, was it a sloppy win? Could they have played better? Did they make a ton of mistakes? Yes, all of that is true. And they can fix all of that after a win. And you'd rather them fix it after a win than a loss. And you heard Josh Hart say that after the game. And that's how you want to go about it. Now, looking at this game, coming into the series, and I tweeted this out, I said that I wasn't overly concerned with the Pacers' pace. Okay? No pun intended. I have no concerns. I'm not overly concerned with it because the Knicks have been playing against the Pacers and this pace for a couple years now. Now, I understand the Pacers have different players and Siakam's here now and all that. I get it, but they've been playing against this pace for a couple years now. And last year, the Knicks smacked the Pacers around most of the year when they were healthy. They had no concerns about the Pacers. The whole Wally Szczerbiak's fake all-star, wannabe fake all-star comment came because Jalen Brunson had cooked Halliburton once again. Halliburton had a great first month or so, 2 months of the season last year. And it's almost like he was grandfathered into the all-star game. Whereas Jalen Brunson was dominant from about December on. And then Halliburton had missed a bunch of games too, right before the all-star break. And everybody just anointed Halliburton the All-Star berth last year, and Jalen missed the whole All-Star team and had outplayed him for a longer period of time in the first half of the season. That's what prompted Wally Szczerbiak to make that comment, and I'm not defending the comment. It was a stupid thing to say. But the reason why he said it was because Halliburton was being gifted stardom at the time. Now you come into this year, and Halliburton once again started the season off on fire and then tailed off from January on because of injury or whatever you want to call it. Jalen Brunson has been dominant the entire season. Meanwhile, Halliburton slides into the All-Star team. He's on the Olympic team, and Jalen Brunson's fighting for scraps. Jalen Brunson's been cooking Halliburton for 2 years now. So I'm not concerned about the Pacers' pace. The games this year, the Knicks never had a full squad. They were a skeleton crew every single year. And the one game that I hold on to is the game the Knicks played against the Pacers where they had a skeleton crew. The Pacers got out to a big lead. It was a game you didn't expect the Knicks to win. It was the best win of the season. You heard me talk about it on the show 1,000 times. The day Jalen was named an All-Star. He was dominant. Knicks came back in that game, won an exciting game, close game, exciting game. The Garden was rocking. Jalen was in tears in the post game. The emotions got heavy for everybody. It was a great win for the Knicks. Best win of the season. Haliburton was on minutes restriction. He didn't get a chance to play that fourth quarter, so you can give him a little bit of a pass on that. But once again, the Pacers' pace did not bother the Knicks nearly as much as people think it does or think it would. So I wasn't overly concerned about it. Now you see this game, the Pacers were scoring a bunch of points. They scored a bunch of points. They shot efficiently, and the Knicks win the game. Because the Knicks are able, or so far, and things could change, so far with the Pacers, the Knicks have been able to play their game and slow their pace just enough to play their game and keep up with them because the Pacers have some defensive deficiencies. And now, they're not as poor defensively as they were earlier in the year. Siakam has been a big help with that, and they have some excellent defensive players at Nembhard, no more Hield out there, who was a sieve for them defensively. So they have much better defensively than people think they are, but they're not nearly good enough defensively to stop Jalen Brunson. I was going to say stop the Knicks, but that means stop Jalen Brunson. And you saw Jay Williams go on this diatribe talking about how the Pacers defenders are better than the Sixers defenders and they're going to slow Jalen Brunson down. I was like, you have not watched. Jalen Brunson cooks those guys. They're really good defenders. And I was slightly concerned that they increased physicality defensively over the last few months would improve their defensive standing against Jalen Brunson. Nope, it didn't. Nope. The first player in history to have four consecutive 40-point games and 5-plus assists. The first player in history, and you still got doofuses like Chris Broussard trying to question whether or not he's a superstar. Get off of that. You're just trolling Knick fans. Listen to me. People who are still questioning whether or not he's a superstar, they're trolling you. They're trolling you for engagement. Draymond Green and his incessant commentary about the Knicks squad, he's trolling you for engagement. Every time you mention the Knicks and you say something bad, you will go viral on social media, namely Twitter, X, whatever you want to call it. They're trolling you. This is not an intelligent conversation anymore about whether or not he's a superstar. It's not an intelligent conversation. Because when you look around the league to players that they are calling superstars, they've not done anything more than Jalen Brunson has done, and they're not doing what Jalen Brunson is doing. No one has done what he's doing. Some doofus tried to call him a shot chucker. Now, in the Sixers series, he struggled. Game 1 and Game 2, he struggled. And in Game 5, he held the ball too long and didn't score consistently down the stretch of that game. So after Game 5, you saw people asking if he was a shot chucker. He is shooting 50% from the field. He's not a shot chucker. He's shooting 50%. 50%. Are you for real? And he's not even shooting a three ball well. I said in the Sixers series after game two, I said if this guy turns this series around for himself offensively, it's like he would be like MJ to me. And I was like joking around when I said it. Because I thought the Sixers' defense and scheme was just too much for him to be dominant. The man just went and scored 40 points every single game. And the game he didn't score 40 points, he scored 39. You're talking about, I've never seen anything like this before. Do you understand? Do you understand? When I was a kid and Michael Jordan was everybody, Michael Jordan was all world. Jordan this, Jordan that. I'm a Knicks fan. You know what? Jordan kissed my, you know what? I didn't even want to watch his. I didn't want to hear it. And then after a season or two of watching him, I think it was against Phoenix. I was like, you know what? I'm just punishing myself by not giving this man his kudos, man. This man is off the charts. He's off the charts. He's doing amazing things every single night. How do you, How do you not watch him? How do you not appreciate what he's doing? And even though my Knicks teams are losing to him every year, I was never a Jordan fan. I wasn't a Jordan fan at the time, but I'll be the first one to tell you that he was the best to do it, the best that I had ever seen. And once he retired, and you have all these guys coming after him, it was very obvious to me that none of them were as good as he was when it came down to it, because scoring is weighted, right? And you can be a great passer, a great rebounder, and you can do this great and do that great, and blah, 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 blah. But when it came to whether or not this guy was going to dominate the game and put the ball in the basket on top of it on an efficient level, I had never seen anybody anywhere close to him. Kobe was the closest, but he wasn't near as efficient. But Kobe shot threes. But even with his three-point shooting, he wasn't near as efficient as Michael Jordan was. And for much of his career, he had made himself kind of just a... Michael Jordan was pretty much just a mid-range shooter when he was with the Wizards. That's pretty much what Kobe did to himself for, I guess the last 4 or 5 years. Now I'm looking at Jalen Brunson, and no, he's not flying through the air. He's not hanging in the air and doing all kinds of crazy stuff. He's just coming down court and being all around unstoppable. He is 6 feet tall. He's not fast. He's not quick. They're throwing every defender they have at him. He is cooking them. He's cooking them. Naismith fell down, I think, twice in this game. He stumbled twice. He stumbled them up twice. Dancing machine twice in the game. He's just like... Just cool and calm. Like, are you kidding me? He's just shooting fadeaways in your face. What are you doing? You can't stop this guy. 4 straight 40-point games, and the fifth game was 39 points, and he's shooting 50%? What are we talking about? Anthony Edwards, who's absolutely amazing, you're not going to hear me say a bad thing about him. And it's funny the way people compare him to Michael Jordan. When you're watching him play, it does feel like that. He's not shooting 50% every game. He's not shooting 50% every game. Anthony Edwards is a big, strong dude, 6'5", 6'6", and definite superstar, dominates these games at times. He's not doing what Brunson is doing. He's not even shooting as efficiently as Brunson is. I guarantee you Anthony Edwards is watching Brunson and he's saying, I need to do that. If he's doing that, I need to do it. That's what he's thinking. If he's doing it, I need to do it. You know what? Halliburton, I don't know if he was ever actually questionable coming into this game, but he has some kind of back spasms issue. And I believe it, because he did not play well in this game. And some people are saying the lights were too bright. I'm not saying I don't know what happened to Halliburton in this game. He had a really terrible offensive output game. You know, just if you look at the numbers, you know, his effect on the game was a little bit more significant than that, than his numbers would suggest. But it wasn't what you are accustomed to seeing from Halliburton. And, you know, he wasn't like he was earlier in the year, for sure. He hasn't been like that for most of the year. But I tend to believe that he is probably hampered by something. It wasn't like Embiid, who was limping around every other play and wanting everybody to feel sorry for him, but he was scoring 30 points. It wasn't like Embiid. It was like, you know, he's out there, but not out there. And then you see TJ McConnell come in the game and absolutely dominate. And I would have been pissed off that I put together a show right before the series and I couldn't get it out. I would have been pissed off if everybody and their mom had not already mentioned that TJ McConnell is a Knick killer. And every Knick fan, I would say conscientious Knick fans, they know that TJ McConnell is a Knick killer. And some of it is just, you know, he's a crafty little player. It's obvious to me that there's something when he plays the Knicks, because it goes back way before Brunson. It goes way before Thibodeau. There's obviously something TJ McConnell sees the Knicks and he wants to play as best as he can. And it's hard to stop him because, to be honest with you, he's like opportunistic. So he's seeing holes in your defense and he's taking advantage of it. So they gotta figure out how to get the ball out of his hands, I think. But even when the ball's out of his hands, when it finds him and you're rotating defensively, he can be really crafty about it. He's one of those guys that's real hard to do anything about him. But the Knicks made a ton of mistakes in this game. And coming into the game, I think, again, on the show I didn't release, I said, if the Knicks win this game, going away is going to be a short series. So obviously it wasn't going away, and the Pacers, you know, they can I'm not they didn't control the game, but they were up for most of the game by a short margin. You could tell the game was going to come down the wire. I felt like I was basically waiting for the fourth quarter as I'm watching the game and looking at the adjustments the teams are making, because you knew it was going to come down to the wire. And I thought the Pacers missed an opportunity. This was a game that the Pacers needed to win once it got once they kept it close at the end. Because I felt like the Pacers were doing the same thing the Knicks were doing. They were kind of like probing. They were trying things, and they were really feeling the Knicks out. And so and the Knicks were kind of feeling them. And I think once the Pacers saw that they had a chance to win the game, they tried to turn it up. But that's when the Knicks and Carlisle mentioned this after the game. That's when the Knicks turn it up. And it's almost like they're playing harder at the end of the game than they were most of the game. Much harder than most teams, much harder than most teams can play at the end of the game because they're getting tired. So it's like where everyone else is getting tired, the Knicks are getting more energy. And Carlisle alluded to that after the game. So the Pacers, I don't think they lost their composure. They might have taken some shots they shouldn't have taken. They made mistakes like the Knicks made mistakes. The Knicks made more mistakes, I think, than the Pacers even did. I think the Pacers were ready to win that game at the end, and they couldn't pull it off. And they got a bum call with that kickball violation that wasn't a kickball violation. I'm not mad at the moving screen. I know that's not a call that's typically made at that point in the game. But what two things? DiVincenzo, he got called for blowing a screen up a couple possessions prior. So you can say it was a little bit of a makeup call because that screen was an illegal screen. It was just as illegal, maybe even more so. Brian Scalabrine broke this down on his radio show. Your legs, your feet are not supposed to be wider than your shoulders on the screen. That's why Bam Adebayo is illegal screening like all the time. He's like a left tackle. His legs are really, really wide, and he puts his hands on you, and he kind of slides with you as you're trying to get around it, which makes the screen impossible to guard. And that breaks your entire defense down. I don't think people recognize that those illegal screens, I know the players do, but I don't think fans recognize, and people who talk about it, I don't think they recognize how damaging those illegal screens are. They really bring the guards open, and it breaks your entire defense down if you can't get around it. And it gives Miami an incredible advantage when he's able to get away with those illegal screens. Now, just in general, a lot of teams get away with illegal screens, which brings you to the point of calling it at the end of the game. But what people are dismissing is that DiVincenzo was getting called for blowing a screen up. That was also an illegal screen, and that probably should have gone the other way. But instead, Naismith flopped. He was really wide on his screen. He flopped when DiVincenzo tried to get around it. And the reason why you know it was BS is because at that stage of the game, DiVincenzo was not going to run through the chest of Naismith, right? The only reason why he was lined up with the chest of Naismith is because Naismith was moving on the screen and he was super wide on it. And they called that foul on Naismith and gave free throws to the, I mean, they called that foul on DiVincenzo and gave free throws to Indiana. It was at worst, it was a makeup call. But then if you look at it, and this is why the last 2 minute report is always trash. Right, they're going and they reviewed it. Obviously, it was challenged. They reviewed it and they said it was an illegal screen. And the last 2 minute report is going to say it was an illegal screen, too. And if I'm a Pacer, I'm going to say both things are worthless because they called it by the letter of the law. And by the letter of the law, it was an illegal screen. But if you're not calling it consistently throughout the game, then it doesn't matter. But in this particular case, it was a makeup call. So, as much as you're saying it cost you the game and they cheating for the Knicks. please go look at around the 2.5 minute mark when a call was made that puts you on the free throw line and shouldn't have been there. It should have been a turnover. So let's keep that in mind. But that kickball violation, that was a BS call. It was a mistake. That should have been a turnover in the Knicks. And it's time to talk about that. At the end of the game, the Knicks were once again a little shaky with the ball. And Brunson was shaky with the ball. There were at least three plays where Brunson, one play, Brunson dribbled off the foot of Nembhard. And it could have very easily been a turnover. It had to be challenged in order for the Knicks to get the ball back. But that play he tried to make, it was a bad play. You got him getting trapped on the sideline and having to throw the ball off Halliburton, and the ball hit him while he was out of bounds. You shouldn't be in that situation. And then you have him trying to split the double team with the pass and Naismith getting his hands on the ball. So what you're seeing is you saw them trapping Brunson and getting some tangible results by, first of all, you know, the Nembhard full court pressure. It wasn't a trap. Jalen just screwed up. He guessed right, and Jalen ran into his chest. Could have been a foul called, but if you want to do a play on, I'm perfectly fine with it. And Jalen ended up almost dribbling the ball out of bounds. Now, Jalen's used to the full court pressure. In the fourth quarter, they're going to let you get away with a little bit more contact. He's probably going to need Hartenstein to come up there and set a screen early up court to get people off of him, especially late in the game when he's wearing down. I don't know if it was Carlisle's plan the entire game to play Brunson essentially 1v1 and then to trap towards the end and turn up the pressure towards the end of the game when he starts to wear down. I don't know if that was his plan, but that's how it went. And I think that's what you're going to see a lot more of. And the traps, again, I don't know if it was his plan to trap later in the game when Jalen starts to get a little bit tired, springing on him so they don't get used to the trap and get used to who's trapping and get used to how they want to attack it. But to do it in a close game at the end, I think it's kind of genius to spring it on them at the end of the game. I don't know if that was a plan, but that's how it went. So what you're going to see probably next game, if you see Brunson again facing that same defense, you know that in that fourth quarter late, you're going to start to see those traps with really active hands. And you saw the Pacers were timing the passes, right? So they were trying to deflect the passes. It wasn't just like token pressure. It was super aggressive. I know that you're going to pass it. I'm waiting for you to pass it. I'm trying to anticipate the pass and trying to deflect it out of your hands. That's what they were doing at the end of that game. So I'm wondering if you're going to see that kind of pressure on Brunson. Is it a thing where they discovered something at the end of the game, so you're going to see it most of the game in game two? Or is it a thing where they're just going to spring it on them at the end? I'm real curious how that's going to go. I know that Carlisle, and you know, very good coach, I know he didn't go into this game thinking that they were going to stop Jalen Brunson 1v1. Maybe he was curious about it, but it's hard for me to imagine that. It's much more likely to me that he felt, hey, we'll do our best against Jalen 1v1, and then when it comes down the stretch, we'll trap him. Hopefully he's a little worn down. We can force him into some mistakes. I think that's how he went about it. And it wasn't a bad idea. So there's something that Jalen has to clean up, and it's no problem. We've seen this in the Sixers series too. But different players, different personnel, different kinds of attacks. I think Jalen, we talked about this all year long about when Jalen's blitzed and trapped in the half court, about how he has to get rid of the ball quicker sometimes. But sometimes it's not about being quick. Sometimes it's about being measured. I mean, it's not one answer, right? Sometimes it's about getting the ball out of your hands quickly, or maybe in the half court. Maybe when you see the trap coming, if you can anticipate it, you get it out of your hands quickly. But sometimes it's about making the right pass and being measured about it. You got to feel it out scenario by scenario. Being patient and let things develop. It's not just about him. It's about his teammates being in the right places. If it's going to be a full court press, being in the right places on the court. And if he gets that ball out properly, then the Knicks can find transition opportunities. You know, so a lot to learn from this first game one. You don't overreact to game one losses. You don't overreact to game one victories. But when you're in a home team, you don't want to lose game one. It's a bad omen for the rest of the series. So you win this game however you can, and they did that, and you learn from those mistakes, and you move forward. They made a lot of mistakes in the half court. Now, you know, I think it's just to talk about it on the show, but people talked about it incessantly, how the Knicks were going to handle the high screen and roll, the pick and pop with Miles Turner, etc. The Pacers are going to make the weak side corner passes much more frequently than the Sixers did. They're going to pass out of those dribble handoff and pick and roll options at the high screen roll options much more frequently than the Sixers did. And I think, you know, that's going to be especially challenging for the Knicks, who were helping a ton in the paint off those actions with Maxey and Embiid. Whereas if you do that against the Pacers, they're going to find open looks. But I think in this first game one, I think you saw a lot of mistakes from the Knicks. They didn't communicate well. You know, you didn't see, I'm not going to say you didn't see second efforts, but you didn't see third and fourth efforts getting out to shooters. You saw a lot of guys just kind of looking around. I think I tweeted out that Hartenstein was hanging on to Halliburton when he was coming off those screens downhill. He was hanging on to him just a tick too long when it was obvious that Halliburton wasn't going to get all the way to the rim. That's when you got to get back to the shooter. It was almost like he was expecting someone else to rotate to the shooter. And you know, you got burned by that a couple times. It wasn't fun seeing Siakam go right at Ananobi and get some and have some success in the post, but it did seem like he was going to the same move. So maybe Ananobi can, you know, start measuring that shot a little bit more. He didn't seem to have a whole lot of trouble shooting over him for most of the game, but in the fourth quarter he missed some shots. In the fourth quarter I was thinking how Ananobi needs to overplay that fadeaway jump shot towards the middle of the floor, and Siakam kind of brought it back. I forget, I think it was a spin move where he brought it back towards the baseline. He kind of fumbled the ball out of his hands on his shot. You know, so Siakam's a good player. When there's no help at the rim, you know, if he's going to shoot that fadeaway on Ananobi successfully, then to me that's going to be problematic. But if he's trying to get the ball to the front of the rim on Ananobi, I think, you know, my money's going to be on OG to stop that eventually. But I think you didn't see a ton of it, and I got to rewatch the game. I know you might have seen it late in the fourth quarter. I don't think you did, though. I think sometimes you can put Hartenstein on Siakam. If Siakam's going to just try to dribble to the middle of the floor and shoot a fadeaway, or he's going to try to post you up in the mid-post and do something like that, you can put Hartenstein on. You're not going to do it every possession and let Siakam measure himself against Hartenstein and line him up and iso him. But you can definitely do it, you know, off rotation, you know, switching in action on a possession here and there. You got to switch it up. And I think Tibbs knows that. But I think what you saw in the game is I didn't feel like the Pacers were unstoppable. I just felt like the Knicks were making a lot of mistakes defensively. And that has to be a good sign for you going into game two. Now, for the Pacers, though, I felt like the Pacers were kind of feeling out in this game. I just, you know, even though they played with a good pace, you didn't feel like they played as confidently and as aggressively as they could. And you don't know if the lights were a little bright in this game, if they were trying to be a little bit more measured, or maybe that's how they want to approach the series. But they didn't feel like, even though their pace was faster than most teams, it didn't feel like they were, you know, except for that second unit in the second quarter, it didn't feel like they were just coming at you nonstop, attacking play after play after play. It seemed like they were in the half quarter a good bit more than you would have expected. It seemed like they were playing almost comfortably where they were in the game, where they were comfortable being this, 4 or 5 point lead, managing the game. It seemed like they were playing maybe at 75, 80% of what they could play. So that's a good sign for them going into game two. And Halliburton had a horrible game and they had every chance to win this game, right? You did get an excellent game from TJ McConnell too, so it kind of balances out. But they have a lot of promise going into game two. If they're like, yo, if they're going to do this, then we're going to, they're confident in the game plan, they're confident in their ability to execute. You can see them turn it up a notch, especially if they have an ace in the hole when it comes to Brunson. And they're like, yo, we're going to blitz Brunson randomly throughout the game, or we're going to switch Miles Turner on him. We're gonna throw different things at him in this game that we didn't throw at him in the first game. And if we reduce his efficiency even a little bit, then we win the game, right? If we take away Devo a little bit, we win the game. Take away Hart a little bit, we win the game. Because they let Josh get off, doing nothing special, and they let Devo get off doing nothing special, and they didn't even double team Brunson. So they have a lot to look forward to in this game too as well. So, like in most series, game two is a big game, especially for the road team, because if they can just get one in the garden, they're going to be happy with that. And I can see an old cagey coach like Carlisle thinking, hey, I'm not going to show my hand in this game one. Let's just see if we can manage this game one, and then, we'll throw some things at them at the end, and then we'll save these wrinkles for game two, and we'll go super hard this game two strategically to see if we can get this steal this second game. I can see Carlisle going at it like that. It's not like he's throwing the game. It's like, hey, they had a chance to win, and Carlisle knows that once he comes out of that game one, that Tibbs is going to see everything he's doing. He's going to counter it for game two. So if you don't win game one, if you throw everything out there in that game one, and you got a coach like Tibbs that's going to see it and adjust to it in game two, then your chances of winning game two are going to be dramatically decreased. And then what are you going to be doing for the rest of the series? You don't want to go down 2-0. It's not the end of the world, but you just don't want to go down 2-0. So I can see Carlisle looking at the Knicks and saying, listen, I think this team can beat us, but we can beat them too, but we have to be smart about it. And managing this game one by keeping a couple tricks up his sleeve for game two. So I'm real curious about game two. And typically when it comes to these games, you want to see what adjustments are made in that first quarter. The first quarter is going to tell you a lot. With a team like the Pacers, the second unit is going to tell you a lot. What adjustments are the Knicks going to make against that second unit? You saw a little bit of Precious in this game. Played like 4 minutes, but you're not going to see a ton of them. The one thing I did like is that Mitchell didn't seem like, and I talk about this all the time, it's not to kill Mitchell, is that sometimes he just doesn't have that quick twitch, reaction, instinctive gameplay needed in these spots. And what he did in the Sixers series is sometimes he would get better throughout the game. Sometimes he comes into the game sharp. It didn't seem like he came into this Pacer game sharp, and Tibbs had no patience for it. Took him right out and put pressures in the game. You'd like to see that because that's how you have to win. You can't go down with the ship. If he doesn't have it, he doesn't have it. Right? So you put pressures in, and pressures didn't really make a mark, but it was only 4 minutes. They got blasted in that second quarter. I won't put it all on pressures. But that's the only way you're going to see pressures is if the game is just too fast for Mitch. I think Carlisle, give Carlisle credit because he threw Isaiah Jackson in there, knowing Isaiah Jackson was just going to outwork and outmove and outmaneuver Mitchell Robinson. So maybe that's not the matchup. Maybe you want to see Mitchell Robinson against Miles Turner more. And we know that Miles Turner can give Mitchell Robinson some problems shooting the ball. But like I said, or tried to say in the show that didn't get released, but you saw Mitchell Robinson get much better at guarding the perimeter with Embiid as the series went on. And Embiid was a much more versatile shooter from out there. It wasn't an aggressive shooter, but a much more versatile shooter in the sense that if you got too close, he'll get by you. And if you took gave him too much room, he'd shoot it right there in your face. Miles Turner's not going to be that aggressive shooting the ball out there. He'll shoot it if he's open. If you chase him off the shot, He might put the ball on the floor, but that's not really their game. So if Mitchell Robinson shows a little bit more of what he showed in some glimpses in that Sixers series, and gets his hand up, keeps his hand up against Turner, and scares him off that shot, you might be able to nullify a couple of possessions against Turner until Hartenstein gets back in the game, and then you can maybe utilize more Precious against, I'd say, Jackson in that second unit. I don't know if it's going to play out that way, but I think that's a better way of going about it, right? Now, as far as Precious spelling people at the, OG and Hart at the power forward position, that's where it gets tricky because you talked about it all year, right? Precious defensively has been really good at the power forward position, but offensively he's a drag. And defensively at the five position, he started off being a little slow defensively, but then picked it up at the five and got better at it, and he becomes a pretty good option at the five position offensively, especially when you juxtapose it with Mitchell Robinson. All right, so I think that's a reason to have Precious have more minutes at that five. He can give you good minutes on both sides of the ball, regardless if it's Miles Turner or Isaiah Jackson. And when it comes to power forward position, that's where it gets tricky. And we mentioned this as a reason why he wasn't playing that much in the Sixers series, the power forward position. If Josh Hart is never going to sit down and you're playing three guys who aren't floor spacers, right? That's the mindset. At the same time, you're seeing now that Josh is a little bit of a floor spacer, right? He's playing well spacing the floor. So have a little bit of faith in Josh. We're not talking about 10-minute stretch here. We're talking about not 5 minutes. We're talking about maybe 2, 3 minutes. That's it. Let's just make it two. At the power forward position, have Precious put up 500 shots every day. He's probably not going to get more than one or two shots out there in a 2, 3 minute stretch. And if you want to, if you're playing with Hartenstein, you can invert it and have him set the screens and have Hartenstein go, because Hartenstein can hit that shot. I don't know if he's taking it in practice the last 2 years because Tibbs gave up on him in 2 months last year. But we're talking about 2 minutes, and you're talking about a chance to get a playoff win. Let's just keep it that way. And if we're talking about for 2 minutes, can you put Hartenstein in the corner and for three or four possessions, put Hartenstein in the corner and do high screen and roll with Precious Achiuwa? Because you hit him with the pocket pass, he can dunk it on you. He's shown that he can be effective in a lot of the ways that Mitchell Robinson isn't effective, even though Mitchell has ways that he's better than Precious. You can use all of them. And if you have to stick Hartenstein in the corner for three or four possessions, then do it. If you have to we're just going to run it the way we normally run it and put Precious in the corner for two or three possessions, then do it. Because you know what? The Knicks did it in the regular season in games they needed to win too. And Precious showed up in those games, big games, games that felt like playoff games. Precious stepped up, and when the spacing was terrible, he stepped up. He still made plays. He still helped the Knicks win a lot of those games. And in games when they lost because the spacing was terrible, it was because you had to play Precious for 40 minutes. We're talking about 2 minutes. I need Tibbs to do this now. And I talked about this going into game six, and the Knicks won, and I told people, I said, listen, give Tibbs credit. I wanted Precious to play. He didn't play him. He won the game. I don't question it. I don't question it. Whatever you did, it worked. It worked. I'm not going to be one of these guys that has to win my way. It worked. But this is something that I think they need to do. It was for different reasons against the Sixers, but here against the Pacers, you need to. Once again, not let them take advantage of Mitchell Robinson like they did in this first game. And two, give some of these guys a chance to rest a couple more minutes. And I'm not doing the minutes police thing. These guys are adults. They hear it. They're trying to win a championship. Do you understand that's what they're trying to do? I see people talking about Jalen Brunson's playing too much. He's not going to be able to score 40 points every night. You got to play Alec Burks. Do you know how stupid that sounds? to take Brunson out to put Alec Burks in because you don't think he's going to continue doing what he's doing? You got to play him as long as you can play him. The answer is not going to be Alec Burks. Remember I told you in one of the other shows somebody was advocating for them to rest the Knicks in game two to keep them fresh for the rest of the series? What world do you live in, man? These people live in a bizarro universe. Brunson's going to play 40 minutes. He's going to play big minutes. All right? But you know what? He doesn't have to play 40, and he didn't play. He doesn't have to play 48 minutes. You know? He can play 42 minutes. He can do that. There's a lot of weight on his shoulders. You want him at closer to the 40-minute mark, to be honest with you. Especially if they're going, if their plan is to wear him down so they can pressure him down the stretch. You want him closer to the 40-minute mark. The way you do that is to give Precious a few more minutes. It's not, and no, doofus, I don't want Precious to play point guard. But if you put Precious in, put him at the power forward position just for 2 or 3 minutes, it'll allow Devo to be fresher. It'll allow Hart to be fresher because you can give them a break if you're doing that each half. You can give them a little bit of a break. And if they're fresher, and maybe you can get away with a couple more possessions of Jalen sitting on the bench. Because they can, maybe they make more plays. Maybe they're a little bit fresher. And I'm not trying to be the minutes police here. It's just that I realize that the Knicks are playing with a skeleton crew here. They're not going to play Alec Burks. You understand? They're not going to play him. Because when they needed Alec Burks to play well in the regular season, he didn't. So as much as Tibbs loves Alec Burks, he did not perform. Alec Burks is also dealing with a shoulder injury that he's trying to tough out. So he's playing. He's got a little bit of an injury, and I don't know if he had. I don't think he had the injury the whole time. As a matter of fact, I remember reading that he didn't have it the entire time he was with the Knicks. So he wasn't playing well, and now he got some kind of injury that he's playing through. So you trying to play a hurt Alec Burks? I see people talking about playing Melton. We're not doing this, man. You're not. They're trying to win a championship, which means one game at a time, get victory, one game at a time. Tibbs is going to manage each game like it's the last game in the universe. Because he doesn't have the depth the Pacers have. He doesn't have the depth of any of the remaining teams in the playoffs. Because of injury. And those are not injuries because they were playing too many minutes. Okay, Bogey didn't almost break his foot because he was playing too many minutes, doofus. He has to keep the best players, most trustworthy players that he can count on the floor as long as possible. And that's not Alec Burks. Not Melton right now. But Precious has proven himself. That's why I'm not going to say I don't understand it. Totally, but that's why I can't roll with it. Like, I can't give a pass on it. Because Precious has earned this opportunity. He has been trustworthy. And I understand that you have spacing issues, but you should just be putting Precious up 500 shots a night. That's it. How many shots do you think Precious is going to get in 2 minutes? If it doesn't work, you pull the plug. Anyway, that's a problem for another day because, once again, Tibbs managed the game and got a victory. I think too many of you have this impression. Do I think the Knicks are a better... Let me phrase it this way. I think the Knicks are a more capable team than the Pacers. I don't think the Pacers are very versatile in their ways, in their paths to victory. The Knicks are. That doesn't mean the Pacers can't beat the Knicks, though. This is a game of matchups. You know, when I didn't want to play the Sixers going into the first round. And you should have seen at this point that was not necessarily a bad idea to not want to play that team. Even though I did see somebody on social media say that the Knicks would have beaten the Pacers beaten the Sixers in less games if Tibbs used the bench. I thought that was especially hilarious. But all that is people thinking that the Knicks are better than they are because they're, you know, they're fans. People thinking that they're better than they are. So when expectations aren't reached, and I talked about this before the playoffs, they have to look for people to blame. And obviously it's going to start at Tibbs. And then it also fell to Brunson for a few people. This team is not, I thought they were going to sweep the Sixers, and they don't sweep the Sixers. And things look like a little bit bleak when things are 3-2 or 2-1. Oh, Tibbs not doing this, and Brunson's not doing that, blah, blah. No. This team lost an all-NBA player out of their starting lineup. This team lost a 20-point scorer coming off the bench. This team does not have the depth. One of the strengths of this team was their depth. This team does not have the depth, and Alec Burks is not playing well. Like, so, I mean, that's the part where, you know, that's everything else is out of your control. That one kind of is in your control, and that's just, you know, hey, put the blame on Alec Burks. He would be a real big help if he didn't play like such a trash player when he was getting minutes. He'd be a real big help right now. But you're looking at what this team is capable of. You're looking at the good feelings this team is giving you. And you're thinking, oh, they're better than the Sixers. Oh, no, they're able to, they're capable of beating them. They're not necessarily better, they're capable of beating them. And they did. You're looking at the Pacers, oh, they're better than the Pacers. No. Okay, sure, the Pacers got away with one getting out of the first round with the Bucks and all their issues. But you know they can pull this off. If you're watching, you know they can pull this off. You know they can steal a few. So every game they win is a bonus. So no matter, oh, you should have done this, should have done that, they should have been better at doing this, they almost did this, blah, 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 they won. And that's it. You move on to game two. Now game two becomes the biggest game because you don't want to get the Pacers to split and that, period. So if you're a little delusional and you're like, oh, the Knicks are going to sweep the Pacers and the Pacers can't hang with the Knicks and blah, 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 and you see a game that they almost lost and very easily could have lost, then you got to start blaming people. You start saying silly things like play Alec Burks instead of Jalen Brunson. All right, I'm simplifying it, but still, yes. Just the statement of play Alec Burks is like, why? Why? Oh, they're going to burn the, he's going to burn the players out. Okay, if they get burned out, they get burned out. That's just the way it is. You don't change the way that they've been winning. Don't change it. Don't change it because you're worried about something that might happen in the future. You got to play every game like it's the only game. That's the only way you get through this. You can't get cocky like that. And like I said, the reason why I advocate for Precious is because Precious played these minutes. He played these pressure-filled minutes when the Knicks needed to win. He was there. He was there for them. He came through. So you know that you have to have some faith in him. You can't have it with Alec Burks, not now, not with the way he played in those same spots. He didn't come through. And Bogey was on the verge of not playing either until he started to come through towards the end of the season. So you start to have faith in him. All right. So Precious, to me, Precious sits at the table. He's allowed to sit here. And that's why I think he should play. But everyone else, trust Tibbs, man. You don't get here without Tibbs. This is not a full squad. Everybody else is playing with a full squad. You understand that? The Knicks are one of the final four teams in the Eastern Conference with a hamstrung roster. And you want to give Tibbs a hard time. All right? One thing at a time. Give him a break. Give him a break. And just enjoy this ride. Because they can end right here in this Pacers series. If you start doing some of the silly things that people are suggesting, it can end right here in this Pacers series. You can say that about my suggestion. This guy, he's figured it out. He's figured it out all his time. At the end of the day, give him his kudos and have some faith. So, the truth is, I was going to end the show right there. That was the end of the show. The show was about to go to print, as they say. And then I see this breaking news that Mitchell Robinson is out 6 to 8 weeks because he re-injured that same ankle that he had a surgery on earlier in the year. Same ankle that dirty ass Embiid hurt in game three. So while everyone's waxing poetic about this dirty player, playing injured, Mitchell Robinson's been out there giving yeoman's effort ever since, after having re-injured that ankle, and we all know it, you see him limping around, but re-injured to the point where he's going to be out for 6 to 8 weeks. This man was out there playing with an ankle dangling off his foot. This is the way I see it. And I see people criticizing him for being, you know, fragile and he's never healthy, all of that. Listen, it's not the time for that. This man gave you everything he had. He gave you everything he had. And I sat here early in the show and I criticized, not harshly, but I criticized, you know, some of the gameplay and advocated for Precious playing and sat there and gave you all of the million reasons why I thought Precious was, you know, not necessarily the better play, but needed to play in addition to Mitchell Robinson. Now you don't have a choice. Now you don't have a choice. And the first thing I want to say, if we're going to keep it basketball, is even if you think Precious is going to do a good job, now you don't have depth. So now Hartenstein gets in foul trouble, or Precious gets in foul trouble, you got really nowhere to go but OG Anunoby. Because none of those other guys on that bench are going to come out there and play center. So from a depth standpoint, They're out of luck. Now, I had a friend ask me if they can sign anyone. I quickly told him no, because the playoff rosters, the final, but there may be some kind of emergency, you know, because the Knicks also lost Bogdanovich. There may be some kind of emergency provision when you're down to... I've been using the term skeleton crew all this time, but they're really down to a skeleton crew now. So I'll find that out by the next show, by tomorrow. But listen, I just want to make sure we give Mitchell Robinson his proper respect. He went out there and gave it all he got. And he did it for the fans. He did it for his teammates. He did the best he could. Salute. Now, on the basketball front, now that that's said, I made an argument for why Precious that you would need to play in this series and in future series, quite frankly. Against Embiid, and you can make the argument that Precious would have held his own because he played Embiid well, but Mitch Robinson made a lot of big plays when, you know, he had some good, he had some bad, but he made a lot of good plays in that series, and he fought MB when he's trying to post up, all those sprints in the post and get an offensive foul in the deciding game from MB. Excellent work. But in this series now, I don't think Precious Achiuwa hurts you. And I made the argument for, you know, how Mitchell Robinson could potentially struggle, especially against their second unit. And the one guy I don't think is going to struggle is Precious. Now, the one thing that Mitchell Robinson does not do well, that Precious does. And, you know, I'm not going to sit here and go through all the things that Mitchell does well that Precious doesn't. But, you know, Precious is not perfect, especially at the center position. But the one thing that he's going to do that Mitchell's not going to do is he's not going to put the ball in the basket unless you spoon feed him. And even if you do that, he drops the ball a good bit. Precious, he doesn't have the greatest hands in the world, but they're pretty decent. You can do the short roll with him, and he can dunk it. He can go down the lane and dunk it. He can put the ball on the floor, take a couple dribbles and dunk it. He can run in transition and make a play. He can give you a little floater in the middle of the lane. In a series where the Knicks might have to score more points than they did in the last series to get a victory, you got to win different ways. As Tibbs says, you got to win different ways. In a series where you don't want to lose defense, but you still want to be able to keep your offensive potency, Precious is not a bad option for 25 minutes a game. It's not really going to hurt you. Again, there are things that Mitchell does that Precious doesn't. I don't know if you add the pros and cons, what Precious does well, what he doesn't, versus Mitch. I don't know if you come out on the negative with Precious in this series. I think there's unless there's another injury, unless there's foul trouble, what have you, I think the Knicks might actually be in the plus with Precious playing in 25 minutes a game in this series. You know, assuming you get the best version of him. I think it's a dynamic that helps the Knicks keep up with them offensively and also gives them more options defensively. And I can't wait to see. I can't. Precious is New York born and bred from the Bronx. Precious wants this. He wants this. He wants this spot. He wants to do this for the city. Him getting this opportunity, he can literally propel the Knicks into his gameplay because of the dimensions that he could potentially offer in this series. He could be the difference between the Knicks winning this series in six games, seven games, like it would have been before, and the Knicks sweeping them or winning in five. I'm saying that now. I think Precious can mean that much of a difference. Maybe I'm overstating it. Maybe I'm just a little too high on Precious. And if you've been listening to this show, you know I've been high on Precious ever since, you know, he started to play better after those first couple weeks, man. I think what he brings to you defensively, even at the at power forward position, center position, I think that versatility, it's really something that the Knicks need. I really do. And you're gonna have your good days and you're gonna have your bad days, but if we're just talking about replacing Mitchell Robinson, most of the issues the Knicks ran into when they were playing with a skeleton crew before and Precious was playing big minutes is that he had to play power forward a lot. That's not the case now. You know, you don't get the same rim protection as you have with Mitchell. You know that. You know that. I just don't know if it's gonna hurt you in this particular series. We worry about tomorrow when tomorrow comes. In this particular series, this might be a Precious series. Might be a Precious series. At Sports Ethos on X, Twitter, whatever. At Ethos Knicks, at The Watchers 7, Andre Gallagher. Until next time.